The call came in just after dawn. A woman was down inside her home in Illinois. When police entered, they found a nurse on the floor, shot multiple times. The house was quiet, too quiet. Her children were still asleep in other rooms. Nothing appeared broken, no forced entry, no sign of a struggle that spilled outside the walls. First responders worked fast, but there was nothing to save. Death was clear. The room held the evidence now: shell casings, blood patterns, silence. Investigators locked down the house and began the first hour clock. Who knew the layout? Who could walk in without resistance? Who had reason to be there when the lights were still off and the neighborhood was waking up? Before the day was over, one name surfaced again and again: an estranged husband, a bitter separation, a custody fight that was still active. What looked like a quiet domestic space had just become a crime scene with a narrow circle of access and a rapidly closing window. Chapter 1: The Scene and the First Hour. Police arrived while the street was still dim. Porch lights were on. Frost clung to parked cars. Inside the house, the air was still. Rebecca Bliefnick lay on the floor of a bedroom, shot multiple times. The wounds were obvious. First responders checked for signs of life anyway. There were none. They pronounced her dead inside her own home. The time was recorded for the ear, just after 7 o'clock in the morning, February 18, 2023. The room where she was found showed no forced entry. Doors were intact. Windows were locked. The house did not look disturbed in a way that suggested a break-in. The children were still asleep in other rooms. Officers moved carefully. One by one, they checked on them. They were unharmed. They were kept away from the scene. An officer stayed with them while the house was secured. The bedroom floor held shell casings. Blood was pooled and smeared near where Rebecca had fallen. The bed was close by. The walls showed signs of impact. The shots were close range. The noise should have been loud. Neighbors later said they heard nothing. Paramedics stepped back once death was confirmed. Control passed to investigators. Yellow tape went up outside. Patrol units blocked the street. The home became a sealed space. Everything inside it mattered now. The first hour set the direction of the case. Officers photographed every angle of the bedroom. They marked shell casings with small numbered tents. They documented the position of the body before it was moved. Each detail was logged. Time mattered. Memory faded quickly. The front door showed no damage. The back door was the same. No broken glass, no tool marks. Whoever entered did not force their way inside. That narrowed the field. Access became the first question. Investigators moved room to room. They checked drawers, closets, and cabinets. Nothing was ransacked. Valuables appeared untouched. There was no sign of a robbery gone wrong. This did not look random. The layout of the house suggested familiarity. The path from the entrance to the bedroom was direct. No hesitation points, no confusion. Someone knew where they were going. Officers spoke briefly with the reporting party. They gathered basic information only. This was not the time for full statements. They needed facts. Who lived here? Who had keys? Who was expected to be present that morning? Rebecca was a nurse. That came up early. Her schedule mattered. When she was expected to wake up, when the children usually rose. Investigators noted it, but did not chase it yet. The scene came first. A supervisor arrived and took command. He assigned roles. One team stayed inside. Another canvassed outside. A third began notifications. Everyone worked off the same clock. The neighborhood was quiet, suburban, single-family homes. Officers knocked on doors and asked simple questions. Did you hear anything? Did you see anyone? Did anything seem off? Most answers were no. A few neighbors mentioned vehicles they did not recognize. None could describe a plate. None could say for sure when they saw them. Investigators logged it anyway. Small details sometimes mattered later. Inside the house, crime scene technicians began a careful sweep. They wore gloves, shoe covers. They avoided unnecessary movement. The bedroom was the focus, but the rest of the house was not ignored. They checked light switches, door handles, any surface that might hold prints. They collected bedding. They bagged clothing. They documented everything before it was touched. Ballistics would come later. For now, they noted caliber indicators based on casings. They marked locations. They preserved evidence for the lab. The absence of forced entry continued to weigh on the room. It was not proof of anything by itself, but it shaped the early thinking. Someone had either been let in or already had access. Investigators asked about alarms. The system had not been triggered. That mattered. It suggested normal entry or no entry at all because the person was already inside. They asked about recent visitors, maintenance workers, friends, family. That list would come later, but names were already forming in the margins of notebooks. Rebecca's phone was located. It was secured as evidence. They noted its position and condition, whether it was locked, whether notifications were visible. They did not search it yet. That required warrants and time. The children were moved from the house once arrangements were made. Officers explained as little as possible. They focused on safety. The house was no place for them now. As the first hour closed, the tone shifted. The scene spoke clearly. This was targeted. It was personal. The location and timing suggested intent. Investigators held a brief huddle outside. They reviewed what they had. No forced entry. Children unharmed. Direct path to the bedroom. Multiple shots. Early morning timing. They did not name suspects aloud yet. They did not need to. Everyone understood that the circle was small. One officer mentioned domestic cases often turn fast. Another reminded the group to stay disciplined. Assumptions could ruin cases. Facts mattered. The body was prepared for transport to the medical examiner. Before it was moved, final photographs were taken, measurements were confirmed, every step was logged. As the gurney rolled out, the house felt empty. But the pressure did not lift, it increased. The first hour was over, the questions were just beginning. Who had access to the house? Who knew the routine? Who would enter quietly and leave children untouched? Those answers were not in the room anymore. They were out there, waiting to be pulled into the light. Chapter 2. Domestic context and evidence pressure. By mid-morning, investigators shifted away from the house and toward context. The scene had given them limits. Now they needed motive, access, and time. That meant the personal life Rebecca Bliefnik had been living outside the walls where she died. Records showed she was separated from her husband, Timothy Bliefnik. The separation was not informal. Divorce proceedings were active. Custody of their children was disputed. Court filings laid out a schedule of hearings and motions that were still unresolved. Detectives treated this carefully. Separation alone did not equal guilt. But domestic cases carried patterns, and patterns helped structure early work. They pulled the timeline, when the separation began, where each party was living, who had access to the marital home. The house where Rebecca was killed was familiar to both adults. That mattered. It explained how someone could enter without forcing a door. It also raised the stakes around motive. Investigators reviewed recent court activity, custody exchanges, filings over parenting time, communications between attorneys. Nothing in those records proved violence, but the tone showed strain. Language was formal, but the pressure underneath was clear. They requested phone records, not content yet, just call and message logs. Timing mattered more than words at this stage. Who contacted whom in the days leading up to the shooting? Who went silent? Who reached out repeatedly? Rebecca's phone activity showed routine patterns, work-related messages, family contacts, no signs of panic in the hours before her death. That absence mattered. It suggested surprise. They compared that to Timothy's records once legal process allowed it. Again, they focused on timing, location pings, gaps, overlaps. Investigators did not jump ahead. Each step needed support. Firearm ownership became another lane. Illinois records were checked, what was legally registered, what was known to family or friends, what had been discussed in the past. This was done quietly, without assumptions. The caliber recovered at the scene guided the search. Detectives did not disclose it publicly. They kept that detail tight. It was leverage. If someone spoke too freely, they might reveal knowledge only the shooter would have. Interviews began with people closest to Rebecca, co-workers, friends, family. The tone was consistent. She was described as devoted to her children, focused on work, stressed but functioning. No one reported threats or fear tied to strangers. When the topic turned to the divorce, voices tightened. Friends described tension, arguments over schedules, emotional strain. Still, no one claimed to know of plans for violence. Investigators noted what was said and what was avoided. Hesitation mattered. People did not always lie. Sometimes they minimized. The estranged husband was interviewed. This was standard. He was not arrested. He was not charged. He was asked to account for his time, where he had been when he last spoke to Rebecca, what their recent interactions were like. His statements were documented in detail. times, locations, movements. Investigators compared them against independent data, cell phone location, vehicle data, surveillance from nearby areas where available. Inconsistencies did not mean guilt by themselves. Stress could distort memory. But patterns across data streams told a clearer story than words alone. The custody dispute sharpened focus. Control over schedules meant predictability. Predictability meant opportunity. Detectives mapped school drop-offs, morning routines, who was expected where and when. They noted that the children were unharmed and asleep. That was not incidental. It suggested intent directed at Rebecca alone. It also suggested knowledge of the household rhythm. Digital evidence expanded, search histories, app usage, location services. Investigators moved carefully, warrants were precise, overreach could jeopardize everything. The pressure built quietly. Each new data point narrowed the field. The circle of plausible access tightened around someone who knew the home, the routine, and the timing. Still, detectives resisted the urge to rush. They reviewed alternative explanations. Could someone else have had a key? Was there any sign of stalking by an outsider? Did any neighbor report suspicious behavior that could not be explained by routine traffic? None of those lanes developed weight. The absence of forced entry kept pulling the investigation back to familiarity. Ballistics analysis progressed in the background. The lab confirmed characteristics consistent with the casings recovered. That information stayed sealed. It was not shared with interview subjects unless strategically necessary. As days passed, the case did not cool, it focused. Media attention grew, but investigators limited public comment. They released basic facts only. A woman had been killed. The investigation was active, no further details. Inside the task force, discussions became sharper. The question was no longer abstract. It was practical. Did the evidence meet the standard for probable cause? They reviewed the total picture: domestic strain, access to the home, timing alignment, digital footprints, interview statements weighed against data. No single piece stood alone. Together, they formed a pattern that demanded action, but only when legally sound. By the end of the second phase, the investigation had direction. Not a conclusion yet, but momentum. The evidence was pressing inward. The next steps would move the case from investigation to confrontation. That shift would change everything. Chapter 3, Arrest, Trial, and Outcome. The decision to arrest did not come quickly. Investigators reviewed the case again and again. Every report, every warrant return, every data point that tied access, timing, and motive together. Probable cause had to stand on its own. There would be no fixing mistakes later. When the arrest warrant was signed, it marked a shift. The investigation phase narrowed into a single line of action. Timothy Bleefnik was taken into custody and formally charged with first-degree murder. The charge carried weight. It reflected the seriousness of the evidence and the belief that the killing was intentional. The arrest did not end the work. It changed it. Prosecutors stepped fully into the lead. Detectives became witnesses. The case moved from gathering facts to defending them in court. The prosecution's theory was direct. Rebecca Bleefnik was killed inside her home by someone who had access, knowledge of her routine, and motive rooted in a collapsing marriage and a custody dispute. The absence of forced entry mattered. The timing mattered. The children sleeping unharmed mattered. The defense rejected that theory. From the start, attorneys argued that the evidence was circumstantial. They challenged assumptions. They questioned timelines. They raised the possibility of alternative explanations without naming a specific suspect. Both sides prepared for a long process. Motions were filed. Evidence was argued over before a jury ever heard a word. What could be admitted? What had to be excluded? What language could be used? When the trial began, the courtroom filled. Family members sat behind the prosecution. Supporters of the defendant sat behind the defense. The tension was visible but controlled. Prosecutors opened by walking the jury through the morning of the shooting. They did not dramatize, focused on sequence, discovery, the locked doors, the lack of forced entry, the children asleep, the direct path to the bedroom. They called first responders. Officers described what they saw when they entered the house. Paramedics explained their actions and the confirmation of death. Crime scene technicians detailed the evidence collection. Each witness stayed in their lane. Digital evidence followed. Analysts explained phone location data and activity timelines. The focus remained on movement and opportunity, not speculation. Jurors saw charts, maps, time blocks laid out minute by minute. Ballistics testimony established connections between the casings recovered and the firearm characteristics identified. The prosecution did not rely on theatrics. They relied on consistency. The domestic context was introduced carefully. Court records were presented. Custody filings, divorce proceedings. The jury heard about strain without being asked to assume violence. Prosecutors framed it as pressure, not proof by itself. When investigators testified, they explained their reasoning step by step. Why access mattered. Why routine mattered. Why certain avenues were ruled out. They emphasized what was known and what was not. The defense cross-examined aggressively. They challenged memory. They pointed out gaps. They reminded jurors that familiarity with a home did not equal guilt, that marital conflict did not equal murder. They questioned digital data precision. They highlighted areas where timing could be interpreted differently. They pressed investigators on alternative suspects, even those who had been ruled out early. The defense also focused on the lack of direct eyewitnesses. No one saw the shooting. No one heard gunfire clearly enough to identify a suspect. They argued that the case leaned heavily on inference. Throughout the trial, the children were not a focus. The court avoided sensationalism. The dignity of the victim remained central. Rebecca Bliefnik was described as a mother and a nurse, not a symbol. As testimony concluded, both sides gave closing arguments. The prosecution returned to the pattern. Access, knowledge, timing. They told jurors that circumstantial evidence could be strong when it aligned. The defense urged caution. They reminded the jury of the burden of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt. They argued that unanswered questions remained. The jury deliberated. Hours passed, then days. Outside the courtroom, families waited. The outcome would not bring Rebecca back. It would only answer one question. When the jury returned, the room went quiet. The verdict was read, guilty of first-degree murder. The decision closed the central legal question. It did not close the damage. Sentencing followed. The court imposed a prison term consistent with the conviction. The law delivered its consequence. Rebecca's family spoke in the aftermath. Their words were controlled but heavy. They spoke of loss, of children growing up without their mother, of a life ended inside a place that should have been safe. The defense noted its intent to pursue appeals. That was expected. The legal process allows it. The conviction stood unless overturned. For investigators, the case ended with paperwork, evidence logged for storage, files archived. Another domestic homicide resolved in court, but never resolved in human terms. The house where the shooting happened would change owners. The street would return to quiet. The children would grow older with a gap that could not be filled. The case left a mark because it followed a familiar path. Private conflict, escalation, access turned into opportunity, opportunity turned into violence. The verdict answered who the system held responsible. It did not explain why pressure becomes lethal in some homes and not others. That question remains beyond any courtroom. What remained was the record. A nurse killed in her home, a family fractured, a legal outcome that carried finality without relief.